Is everyone able to hear me? Is things coming through sound-wise okay? Great. We love it when things go well. All right. I'm going to do something unique today in giving my five-minute update. I am going to verbalize it rather than actually read you some articles. I'm going to give you the verbal summation of what I see the current developments are. And for those of you who are new to the five-minute update, we are doing this in fulfillment of Ezekiel 33 and Isaiah chapter 62, being watchmen on the walls of Jerusalem. And the basic outline of the end of days for us is that it's prophesied that the nations will divide the land of Israel, Joel chapter 3, verse 2, in the city of Jerusalem, Zechariah 14, verse 2. It will result in the judgment of the nations, Zechariah 14, verse 3, which will entail a war between the nations, Joel chapter 3, verses 9 and 10, and economic collapse of the world financial system. And this will result in reorganization wherein the world will use this to bring about one world government, one world currency. And the God of Israel is permitting this to happen because this sets the stage for him to declare the exile over and to gather the exiles of Israel, wherein in this process he will be glorified. He will be then taking a bride unto himself who will rule and reign with him once he sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives. And so, while there are many prophetic things that are going on, which we are able to watch, we put our main focus on keeping you updated on the current status and situation of the peace process. We are watching developments with Iran and possible war in the Middle East as well as other important as we see fit. And given that I don't have written articles to you, I want to verbalize the conclusion of the written articles if I would share them with you. And so the point I want to share regarding the articles is there are mixed messages that are being portrayed from Israel. And what are these mixed messages? Well, on one hand, in the past week, Benjamin Netanyahu said that Jerusalem will never be divided. And there were those in his government who was saying that we're going to continue to build in Jerusalem, and illegal Arab houses that were not approved to be built are going to be removed. And as you know, this would not help an agreement to establish a Palestinian state. Meanwhile, the United States and the Palestinians have been satisfied enough that they're willing to start the indirect talks. And it was stated today that the first round of those indirect talks have been completed. Now, really what the first round was meant to entail, I'm not sure anyone really knows, other than we were told that the first round were concluded. And I think what they were trying to establish initially is what are we going to be talking about in the talks themselves so that we can get ultimately to the direct talks. And so Israel stated that they wanted to focus on the security issues wherein that they want to focus on the borders and making an agreement on borders. So if that is all the farther that they got, then ultimately here in this coming week, the United States is going to have to step in and decide, okay, what are we really going to be focusing on? Is it borders? Is it security? Which one is going to go forward ahead of the other? Now, if you hadn't heard, the talks themselves have been approved to be for 4 weeks of time. And so they really just got off the ground in this past week. So if we literally take that the talks this week was the beginning of the count of the 4 months. 4 months from now will take us into September. And in September is when we have, of course, the Feast of Trumpets, Yom Kippur, and the Feast of Tabernacles. And so this is when the talks will be concluded. And the Arab world has said that if there is not an agreement at the end of these 4 months, then they're going to declare a crisis. And Barack Obama has threatened that he will even seek to impose a solution and assign blame for the lack of results. And so if things go up to the very last minute until there is an agreement that will be made, that means, according to the outline of their talks, at the end of 4 months of September, that we could have some type in either an agreement in September, or the U.S. seeking to hose a solution. Now, it is prophesied in Joel 3:2 that the nations will divide the land. And Zechariah 14:2, the city of Jerusalem. And it says in Isaiah 28, beginning in verse 14, that the nation makes a covenant and that the covenant would be annulled. And that's Isaiah chapter 28, beginning in verse 14 and going forward. Now, what it's hard to determine at this point was, does this prophecy regard Oslo of September the 13th, 1993 as the covenant that got annulled and then the nations will come and impose the dividing of the land? Or was Oslo the beginning process that there will be an ultimate an agreement by Israel here in our days? Even in perhaps the next few months. And, of course, only time will tell exactly which way it's going to play out. But in speaking about the mixed messages, Benjamin Netanyahu cannot say, in one regard, Jerusalem will never be divided, and at the same time, work as hard as what he worked to appease the United States, to say, you know, in the past year that he's in favor of a demilitarized Palestinian state, that he went forward and declared a 10-month freeze and even got a de facto freeze in East Jerusalem and did other conciliatory measures. Now, if he really wanted to be obstinate, he could have been obstinate from the beginning. But he knows, given that he has stated we want to get to direct talks as soon as possible, and he knows that Obama wants an agreement. He knows Obama wants a functioning Palestinian state in 2 years, that there is no way that the United States and the Palestinians are going to be satisfied in the talks unless Israel is willing to divide Jerusalem. And if Israel is not willing to divide Jerusalem, then Obama is going to assign blame to Israel and seek to isolate Israel. So there's a mixed message that's being portrayed when Netanyahu, on one hand, in this past week, said that Jerusalem will never be divided. And he did this in the celebration of Jerusalem Day, an annual event in Israel, knowing that that position is unacceptable in the negotiations with the United States and the Palestinians. And so ever which way Netanyahu truly intends to play things, going to be revealed here, beginning in the next month and going forward to as long as the four-month period that has been granted for the talks. And then the 10-month moratorium on building in the West Bank concludes on September the 26th. And so it looks like if they're going to play this thing all the way out, that the crisis in the most critical time frame of the talks, being at the conclusion of the 4 months, will be the month of September. And given that Oslo was originally signed on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, Yom Teruah, September the 13th, 1993, that could be this coming September could be a critical time as well. So mixed messages from Netanyahu. What he's saying publicly is not going to be what is needed to be done, the position that he has to take to please the United States, the Palestinians, and the Arab world. So he cannot play it both ways. He's going to have to hear in the next month to 4 months, he's going to have to begin to really reveal his true position. Now, also in the past week or so, Zippy Livni of the Kadima Party, which was formerly headed by Ehud Olmert, she came out and said for the good of Israel that Israel needs to have a coalition government, I forget the term that they use, but it would be a government of Likud, Labor, and Kadima. And Zippy Livni said we need to have that government in order to make the peace agreement and to advance a secular rather than a religious agenda in Israel. So before, she's never given much credence in the same government with Benjamin Netanyahu. There's been friction regarding that from the time of the last Israeli elections. So given that she's now publicly said this is what we need to do, she may be assuring those who vote for Kadima or maybe Labor, and also maybe preparing the Israeli public. But a sign that at least Israel is going to be willing to sign a peace agreement, the sign that we're going to get that's what they're going to be doing is that Kadima will join the government, because Netanyahu won't be able to get a peace agreement accepted by a government coalition. I remember what the word was when Kadima, Labor, Likud to be together. They call that in Israel a national unity government. And so given that Zippy Livni hasn't been in favor of working with Netanyahu in the past, and now she's putting forth the thought that that is what's necessary, perhaps that may be the ultimate direction. But I do not believe that Kadima will join the government unless there is a peace agreement on the table that is understood to be accepted by the United States and the Palestinians. If everything is at that point where they're ready to act upon it, then I think Kadima will join the government. But if it's not at that point, I don't see Kadima joining the government. But based upon what Zippy Livni said in joining the government, that it would be for the purpose of supporting a peace agreement, and secular agenda. Zippy Livni does not like, nor does she like working with the Orthodox Jewish political parties in Israel. That if this came about, where the ultra-Orthodox parties would be alienated if Kadima joined the government, this would be setting the seeds for the prophesied rebellion against the Palestinian state and the ultimate birth of the biblical state of Zion, which is a tribulation event. And so, in essence, then, that is my update regarding the current situation of the peace process, is this mixed message needs to be resolved going forward, and Netanyahu is not going to be able to continue to maintain saying that Jerusalem is not going to be divided, yet tell the United States he's interested in a practical solution, at least in the eyes of the United States, and the Palestinians. Now, regarding the situation in Europe and the sovereign debt crisis with Greece and the British elections, for the first time in about 30 years, there has been what they call a hung parliament in the British elections. One party did not get majority control. So there's a couple parties that joined in to make a government in Britain, just like happens on a regular basis in Israel. And LEAP 2020.eu, reported in their April edition, looked for the possibility this summer that there would be, and as a result, hung parliament election in England, that would put pressure on the pound, and that the pound, which is the British currency, would be under pressure just like it is in Greece. And so as a result of the crisis in Greece, the bankers are calling for a common euro fiscal policy that goes along with their monetary union. So they're once again trying to use the crisis to get centralized or greater centralized control of the European Union. And that's the method that they did on for years. They create a crisis and say that if we don't solve the crisis their way, then we're going to have a catastrophe. But their way is always has the end result of centralizing and the control that they have on things. So they want a greater centralized control of Europe now, since they got a monetary union and a political union, and they also want to use this crisis, and they're calling for putting together a international financial regulation system that can also be centralized, most likely through the IMF or the International Monetary Fund. So the cry is being made, the real necessary framework in order for there to have, in order for there to be one world government and one world currency. And so the next thing, and the final thing I'd like to share with you before Mark wants to come on and take the reins and share some articles with you, is I'm going to give the mic over to Mark, and he's going to play for you really an update where a retired U.S. general is reporting about what he sees as the current situation regarding the military buildup in Syria, Iran, and with Hezbollah and Hamas. And what he's ultimately got to report, it's about 10 minutes, is that he's seeing facts on the ground where Hezbollah in Syria, and working with Iran, that they are strongly preparing for a major war and a major attack against Israel. And this general is going to say that he sees definitely sometime in 2010 the outbreak occurring as soon as the summer. And one other thing, in the Debka file, that is Debka.com, the Debka file intelligence briefing that just came out this week, they are saying that from the news of the past week that Turkey, Syria, Iran, and Qatar are strongly wooing Russia to join a alliance of friendship with them to counter what the United States is seeking to achieve to isolate Iran. And according to the news, it is initially successful that Russia is being agreeable to work with Syria and Iran regarding their desires. And in order to show their commitment, it was asked of Russia that Russia would make a commitment to finish the nuclear reactor that they pledged to do in 2007 that they said could be completed this year, to pledge and then to fulfill their obligation to complete that nuclear reactor in Iran. They also promised to build a nuclear reactor in Syria and then to open up public dialogue with Hamas. And Russia did all it did those things this week, which is what Syria and Iran was asking of Russia to have them demonstrate and show that they were serious in working with them, along with Turkey, that Turkey is working to be a part of the alliance. And basically what is being promised to Russia is that trusted to work with the Arab world and thus could have greater influence with the Arab world if they would join Syria, Turkey, and Iran in this effort. And of course, we could be seeing, a regional war break out with Israel's enemies from the north. So further details on the actual facts of the ground that's going on regarding the military build-up and the possibility of war, I'm now going to turn things over to Mark, and he's going to play to you a clip that is on PJTV, PJTV.com, where a U.S. retiree is going to specify the current situation as he sees it on the ground. And then after this is played for you, it's about 10 minutes, then Mark is going to share with you a couple articles, and he's going to then wrap up the five-minute update for you. So, Mark, giving the mic over to you to play the video clip. Once again, PJTV.com.
Well, we have breaking news now from the Middle East, and you'll be reading these headlines next week. As we're about to learn, conflicts this summer may change our world. Right now, General Paul Vallely joins us to reveal several exclusive and alarming developments in Iran, Lebanon, and Syria. Well, General, what have your sources and research revealed?
Bill, it's heating up very, very quickly, particularly what's happening in Lebanon right now and the northern borders of Israel. And we're getting information directly from the ground in particularly Beirut that is indicating the Iranian strategy and planning, working with Syria, proxy the Hezbollah. Just in the last week, we have very definitive and confirmed information that Iran is actually planning some type of a preemptive attack against Israel to offset an Israeli preemptive attack against Iran. My own feeling is Iran already has the nuclear weapons. They're just trying to figure out how to put that nuclear warhead on the Shahab 3 and launch it. They do have an on-ground capability, we believe, even in the form of dirty bombs. But the other incident that we just received word on, which is newsworthy, nobody else has released this news, is the fact that a submarine docked in Beirut a little over a week ago, a Soviet submarine with an Iranian flag. Probably that submarine came out of the Russian Baltic Fleet. But anyhow, the offloaders had gas masks on and hazmat gear, indicating to me that some form of chemical weapons are being offloaded from the submarine to the control of Hezbollah. Okay. The other indication are the recent reports that have been out there of the more advanced Scud missiles being shipped from Syria to Hezbollah control in southern Lebanon. And we did receive some pictures of where those Scud sites are located. Now, the estimate has been anywhere from 50 to 60,000 rockets and missiles have been placed in southern Lebanon, in houses, in buildings, in orchards, and of course the rockets and missiles they used in 2006 did come from pop-up type of a missile launch system that they've perfected. Now, along with that, we also have the reports of the tunnels that have been dug from southern Lebanon under the fence into northern Israel, much like they did along the Philadelphia line, as you remember, mm-hmm. From Gaza into Egypt. So that tunnel technology now to put through hundreds of young, trained Hezbollah young men and possibly women through the tunnels into northern Israel.
What can you say with some certainty is different in terms of what is going on the ground in Lebanon right now? What are some of the things that you're seeing on the ground in Lebanon? And we'll deal with the actual attack speculation in a minute.
Two things. Number one, the training and infiltration of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard advisors working directly with Hezbollah to make sure all the funding, all the weapons transfers are up and running and effectively to be able to be used against Israel possibly this summer in a preemptive attack.
Okay.
So that we do know. We know the transfers have been made. We know about the tunnels. We know about Hezbollah locking down tight Lebanon just in the last 10 days.
What does that mean? Does that mean that passport restrictions are in place? Does it mean the Internet's being controlled? What does that lockdown look like?
We understand the Internet has been locked down, very tightly controlled. Also, anybody associating with any Israeli will be jailed or assassinated. We see assassinations have increased over the last year over there. So this tight network that Iran controls with Syria and Hezbollah has some of the other factions in Lebanon very worried, such as the Christians and the Druze, who primarily occupy the northern part of Lebanon.
Let's talk now about the Scud missile system, because when we saw the most recent anti-Israeli activity along the border with the Gaza Strip, we saw a lot of homemade rockets. But Scud missile is not a homemade rocket. A Scud missile is a fairly sophisticated intermediate-range ballistic missile. It carries a significant wallop. It's not terribly accurate over long ranges, but it brings a lot of pain to wherever it lands. You say you see signs of Scud missiles in Lebanon?
Yeah, it's been reported, of course, 2 weeks ago, and this was out in the news about Syria transporting those weapons into the Bekaa Valley and areas of southern Lebanon, and we do have some pictures that were taken on the ground of those locations. Now, these Scud missiles are advanced. We estimate the ones they have now 450 kilometers. Which means they can hit almost any main city in Israel, okay? And along with the others that they've already used, they can rain terror down on Israeli cities and towns.
This is something that we can certainly put our finger on. They did, in fact, rain terror on Israeli cities and towns back during Gulf One, when they were, of course, being launched from Iraq under Saddam Hussein. They were landing with conventional weapons, conventional warheads all throughout Tel Aviv and other cities. And the great concern back then in 1990, 1991, was that these Scud missiles are capable of carrying chemical weapons.
That's correct.
What is the concern about a chemical weapon attack from the
Very, very high on the visibility chart for the Israelis. In fact, the report did come out that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the government has issued chemical kits to Israeli families within the last 30 days. So the Israelis know something's going on up there, something very serious. That's why I call the summer of 2010 the tipping point for the Middle East. This can change the whole chessboard over there.
It certainly can.
But the other part of the Scuds and the missiles bill is the fact we know the Iranians, through Hezbollah, are planning to hit and preempt any type of Israeli attack by raining down on all civilian airfields as well as Air Force airfields of the IDF to lock down, close down any air capability the Israelis may have.
And that might
and
be
this is smart. This is very smart on the Iranians' part. This is the first time this has been divulged, by the way.
That would consist of a Scud missile attack on airfields with conventional weapons designed to break up the runways and deny their use to jet aircraft.
That's correct.
All right.
And of course, they learned this from the Israelis when the Israelis did it to the Egyptians. So
this would be used against Israel either in a preemptory sense in order to prevent an Israeli strike on Iranian nuclear facilities, or as a retaliatory strike, which would prevent a second wave or certainly would ground the Israeli Air Force at that
point. So that's the planning. So here's the challenge of the Israelis right now. And this is why we want to get the word out, is that the targets that have been identified and updated by Israel on not only the nuclear sites in Iran, but the regime targets, Iranian Revolutionary Guard, command and control, port-type capability, anti-missile systems that the Russians we know are giving Iran. All of that capability that the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and the Quds Force has will be part of the targeting, I feel, of the Israelis. So it's going to go beyond just the nuclear sites. But here you have now on the chessboard with Syria, southern Lebanon primarily, in a position to go ahead and launch some kind of a ground and missile attack against Israel proper. So that's the new chessboard.
Let's talk about this potential ground attack that could be launched against Israel. There's the idea that there are these tunnels, obviously, between Lebanon and Israel, and that they're able to infiltrate people into Israel through these tunnels. Do you have any indication that the number, quantity, quality, deadliness of people on the Lebanon side of the border is significantly increasing?
Significantly, and the training again of the youth, 14 to 17 year olds, to be able to bring and put on vests, anything to create terrorism and panic in the state of Israel. And so this is a full-blown effort by Iranian proxies and Iranian partners such as Syria. And so that's why I want people to understand this whole chessboard has changed this year. That's why I say 2010. The summer 2010 is pivotal. It can change the whole world.
The rocket attacks that we saw from Gaza are essentially a nuisance, certainly more than a nuisance if it's your house it lands on, but in a wider sense, it's a nuisance. Scud attacks on airfields and especially chemical weapon attacks, this is a whole different order of magnitude that we're talking about.
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely, Bill. That's why it's so serious. That's why we've got to get the word out.
General, it sounds to me that what Iran is doing through its proxies in Syria and Syria through Lebanon is they are trying to make it crystal clear in the mind of the Israelis that if they should launch this strike against those nuclear facilities, then there's going to be hell to pay for it. We're going to launch conventional attacks on your runways. We're going to launch suicide bombers in by the hundreds or thousands to attack your civilian centers. And we may decide to do wide area chemical weapons attack. Do you think they're bluffing?
No, I don't think they're bluffing. I think they planned it out well. And it also includes Bill Gaza and the West Bank. So here you have Israel with the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, basically taking care of any ground attack by Hezbollah, any attacks coming out of Gaza, West Bank, and then southern Lebanon. At the same time, you've got the Israeli Air Forces targeting those targets in Iran. And by the way, everyone should know, Israelis decided 2 years ago, Bill, to put part of their capability offshore, and that's why they acquired Dolphin submarines from the Germans, and those are out there now. So the Israelis have been very good at planning this new initiative by the Iranians, and they're not going to make the same mistakes they made in 2006. They've reorganized, better planning, and they're prepared to do preemptive or defensive operations.
All of this dominoes that are extremely ugly are going to stand or fall based on whether or not the Iranian regime under Ahmadinejad is actually nutty enough to use this weapon if he gets it. You've studied the situation for a long time. Do you think he'd pull that trigger?
Absolutely. I think he'd use it against Israel. I think he'll use it in some way to put some kind of launch capability on container ships and put them off the United States rather than the ICBM capability that they're talking about. But we should fully understand that America, our national security operations, our JCS, Department of Defense, needs to be on top of this, because we cannot allow Israel to stand alone in this.
No, we can't.
All right? We cannot allow that to happen. So the Obama administration has got to get on top of this and make sure that we support whatever is going on over there with the one democratic country in that area against what we call the global caliphate and the spread of terror by Tehran.
Well, General Vallely, thank you very much for coming down and joining us here at PJTV.
Thank you, Bill.
Check test. This one working? I heard. Yes. There's going to be some food to hit the fan this year. You know what? There are a number of people who are saying that the next Jubilee year is going to be 2017. If that's true, and Yeshua comes and announces the Jubilee in 2017, guess what? That means that this Sukkot is the beginning of the tribulation. And it ends next Sukkot. The Sukkot in 2017. Okay? So, keep an eye on this stuff, folks, because we could be seeing the beginning of the time of Jacob's trouble. This. Okay. Now, all of us wackos that look at prophecy and believe that it's actually going to happen the way that it says in the scripture. We may find ourselves being completely exonerated this year instead of being completely nuts. Maybe we've been completely right. We just have, in the past, had the timing wrong. We could still have the timing wrong. I mean, this may not be the beginning of tribulation, but it's going to be pretty close. I mean, it can't be that far off. Okay, so that's enough of my commentary on what we just heard. By the way, that was supplied by Eddie. That clip that we just saw from YouTube or wherever it was, but PJTV. But I'm going to tell you, if I asked him Thursday if he was going to do a five-minute update or if he was leaving it for me, and he said he was going to have a short one. And I said, okay, well, I've got two articles that I want to share right now, and I'm not going to try getting any others. But that would have been one of the things that I played as well, because that I saw that 2 days ago, and that's just so important for us to understand. Okay, I mean the intelligence is coming in, and I don't know where this guy gets his intelligence, but it looks pretty good to me. Anyway, here are the two articles I'm going to share with you. This is from Arut Shava on the 10th of May. Indirect talks begin with a loud silence. Okay, the American-mediated direct talks between the Palestinian Authority and Israel began Sunday with a loud silence, as both sides wait for the U.S. Middle East envoy, George Mitchell, to return to the region, probably in the next 10 days. He is to leave Israel Sunday night. Okay, so that's this past Monday, so they were talking about the night before. The Palestinian Authority officially approved the American initiative to resume what once were described as negotiations in the peace process. Following years of bargaining, the terms of what now is usually called the diplomatic process, the PA has won wide international support for all of its demands. It has been the support of the Obama administration. It has the support, rather, of the Obama administration, which opposes Jewish settlements, decades-old neighborhoods, some of which are populated by nearly 30,000 Jews, in a large part of Jerusalem. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that there must be direct talks before an agreement can be reached, while PA negotiator Saeb Erekat stated in Ramallah, the proximity talks have started. In fact, they took a recess as Mitchell prepares to return to the United States Sunday night, presumably to map out further tactics. With virtually all analysts and observers saying his chances for success are low, the PA is working from the advantage that if Israel does not agree to its demands, it will wait for the right time to turn to the United Nations to pass a resolution recognizing it as an independent country. PA concessions continue to be on the tactical front, agreeing to proximity talks despite Israel's refusal to formally accept U.S. President Barack Obama's demand for a building freeze for Jews in areas of Jerusalem that the PA claims are part of its would-be capital. Under a cloud of confusion, a general de facto building freeze on new Jewish homes is in effect in Judea and Samaria, as well as parts of eastern, southern, and northern Jerusalem. Mitchell has 4 months in which to work, which is the time limit the Arab world has set for the talks to fail or succeed. It also coincides with the approximate end of Israel's 10-month temporary building freeze on new Jewish homes in Judea and Samaria. President Obama is expected to continue to move aggressively to force both sides to accept an agreement, which from the PA side would include sovereignty over all the land restored to Israel in the 1967 Six-Day War. There also are growing suspicions that Defense Minister Ehud Barak, chairman of the Labor Party, that is in the Netanyahu government, has forced a close political friendship with President Obama, who would prefer a new coalition government that includes the Kadima Party, headed by Tzipi Livni. Now, you understand what Eddie talked to us about, putting together a coalition government with Likud, Kadima, and the Labor Party. They're bringing this all together, and they're going to force this issue. The quartet is going to end up forcing Israel to divide their land and to divide the city of Jerusalem. By the way, it's not Israel's land. It is Yahweh's land. And he gave Israel to the land. You understand?
Yep.
So when we force this destruction on Jerusalem, you can guarantee that Yahweh is going to force destruction on the United States. Okay? Watch for it. It's going to happen. That's my commentary on that article. Get rid of that one. Next. Endowed by our Creator. This is by Mark Alexander, and it was published on the 6th in the Patriot Post. Now, here's the link. I think it's being typed into the thing now. http://patriotpost.us/alexander/2010/05/06 endowed-by-our-creator/. Yeah, I know it was long, but I'm hoping you guys wrote it down, and it's probably in the banner by now. Okay, or in the text. And here's the beginning of the article. To the distinguished character of patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of Christian. The signal instances of providential goodness which we have experienced and which have now almost crowned our labors with complete success demand from us in a peculiar manner the warmest returns of gratitude and piety to the supreme author of all good. That was a quote from George Washington. That's what he opened the article with. In 1775, on the eve of the Revolution, the First Continental Congress called for a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer. Apparently, our founders saw a national day of prayer as a fitting observance, not unlike the establishment of Thanksgiving, of which George Washington wrote in 1777, and I quote, being the day set apart by the Honorable Congress for public thanksgiving and prayer, praise, and duty calling us devoutly to express our grateful acknowledgments to God for all the manifold blessings he has granted us. The general earnestly exhorts all officers and soldiers whose absence is not indispensably necessary to attend with reverence the solemnities of the day. That's the end of the quote. Other founders continued in the tradition. John Adams declared on May 9, 1798, as a day of solemn humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that our country may be protected from all the dangers which threaten it. James Madison followed this tradition, but wrote, I was always careful to make the proclamations absolutely indiscriminate and merely recommendatory, or rather, mere designations of a day on which all who thought proper might unite in consecrating it to religious purposes, according to their own faith and forms. In this sense, I presume you reserve to the government a right to appoint particular days for religious worship throughout the state without any penal sanction enforcing the worship. Now, James Madison was the guy that actually wrote the Constitution. Okay, he wrote the original draft of the Constitution. And so he knew what he was talking about when it came to a constitutional way of religious observance. Now, our founders were greatly and rightly suspect of any encroachment by government upon religious freedom, and codified that prescription in Amendment 1 of our Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. If you'd like to see my commentary on that, you can go to Mark Petrone for Congress 2010. I think that's the name of our website, isn't it? MarkPetrone2010.com, and you can see that article that I wrote on the First Amendment. Now, in other words, Congress may not mandate that a particular religion be nationalized and others be prohibited. Our founders were not radical secularists. Far from it. One need only examine their many writings on the subject of, as evidence. But rightly, they didn't want the United States to be wedded with a particular church, as was the case with England and the Anglican Church, France and the Catholic Church, Germany and the Lutheran Church. Okay? They saw the danger in that. Thomas Jefferson, a vigilant though skeptical Anglican, made clear this prohibition in his obscure but maliciously misconstrued 1802 letter to the Danbury Baptist Association. Far from calling for the coercive stripping of all religious influences from public life, Jefferson merely assured the Baptist constituents in Connecticut that their denominational practices were safe because our Constitution provided a wall of separation between church and state, which would prohibit the national government from recognizing Anglicanism as the national religion. Notably, this is in parentheses, notably, 2 days after writing that letter, Jefferson attended religious services in the House of Representatives. And here's a little edit from me. President John F. Kennedy is quoted as saying at a dinner for American Nobel laureates, there has never been a greater concentration of intellectual power here at the White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. You understand he's talking to American Nobel laureates. Okay, these are supposedly the best and the brightest. President Kennedy was no dummy himself. And he said that if our group was in the room with Thomas Jefferson, the intellectual capacity of the room goes down because we're there. That's something else. Okay, but as Madison wrote, our Constitution, the one he penned, does not bar the government from designating particular days for religious worship throughout the state. However, in the latter half of the 20th century, judicial activists, or what Jefferson called the despotic branch, have interpreted the First Amendment to suit their political agendas, placing ever more severe restrictions or constraints upon the free exercise of religion while wholly misrepresenting the aforementioned wall of separation in a concerted effort to expel religious practice from any and all public forums. They have done so by falsely putting forth a living constitution, a revisionist document which has little resemblance to the authentic constitution that once was our republic's standard for rule of law. This is my edit. The Constitution is a living document, for it can change by amendment. But the process for changing it is much more complicated than the whim of 5/9 of a group of legal priests. Back to the article. As noted by former Chief Justice William Rehnquist, the wall of separation between church and state is a metaphor based upon bad history, a metaphor which has proved useless as a guide to judging. It should be frankly and explicitly abandoned. The greatest injury of the wall notion is its mischievous diversion of judges from the actual intention of the drafters of the Bill of Rights. The intended consequence of this artificial barrier between church and state is to remove the unmistakable influence of our Creator from all public forums, particularly government education institutions, and thus, over time, to disabuse belief in a sovereign God and the notion of natural rights. This erosion of knowledge about the origin of our rights, the very foundation of our country and basis of our Constitution, has dire implications in the future of our essential liberty. In 1952, Congress established a National Day of Prayer as an annual event by a joint resolution signed into law by President Harry Truman. The National Day of Prayer designation in 36 U.S.C. Section 119 calls for the nation to turn to God in prayer and meditation. It doesn't say, speak to the Anglican God, speak to the Christian God. It doesn't say, speak to the Muslim God. It just says, speak to God. However you decide that you want to worship God. That's the way you do this. Okay? And there's no proscription if you don't do it. Okay? So, naturally, the despotic branch is challenging that resolution, asserting that religion and politics don't mix. On April 15, 2010, U.S. District Judge Barbara Crabb, a 1979 Jimmy Carter nominee, ruled that the statute establishing the natural day of prayer was unconstitutional, as it is an inherently religious exercise that serves no secular function. That ruling, of course, has no basis in our Constitution, but merely among those who have contorted its true meaning into a grotesque remnant of its original brilliance. Perhaps Ms. Crabb and all other jurists who are attempting to amend our Constitution by judicial diktat, that's D-I-K-T-A-T, spelled in the Russian form, diktat, okay, is in full disregard to the constitutional prescription for amendment in Article 5, should pause and consider the faith of our founders. Perhaps they should look into the depth of faith that motivated the actions of patriot founders John Hancock, Roger Sherman, John Dickinson, Hugh Williamson, Benjamin Rush, Samuel Huntington, John Adams, William Williams, Robert Treat Paine, Rufus King, William Livingston, James Wilson, George Mason, and Patrick Henry, not to mention Samuel Adams, who wasn't part of the constitutional thing, but he was behind the Constitution of Massachusetts, and Jefferson behind the Constitution of Virginia, so the two of them together pretty much formed the basis for our U.S. Constitution. Here are but a few examples of how our founders expressed their faith when in positions of authority. Hancock called on his home state of Massachusetts to pray, quote, that universal happiness may be established in the world, and that all may bow to the scepter of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the whole earth be filled with his glory, unquote. According to John Adams, the general principles on which the founders achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that those great general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence of the attributes of God. The Christian religion is, above all religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient and modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. Suppose a nation in some distant region should take the Bible for their own only law book, and every member should regulate his conduct by the precepts there exhibited. What a utopia, what a paradise would this region be? He's absolutely right. Patrick Henry wrote, the Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. The great pillars of all government and of social life are virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. Do you get that? Let me tell you that again. The great pillars of all government and social life are virtue, morality, and religion. This is the armor, my friend, and this alone that renders us invincible. What's our country looking at now? Is our country, does it have virtue? Does it have great morality? Okay, I'm sorry. Our nation has become a secular, filthy, perverted rag. Yeah, rag's a good word. What would you... it's not what it was meant to be. Okay? I can't come up with a word. My Dane Bramage is working right now. Anyway, Samuel Adams called on Massachusetts to pray that, quote, we may with one heart and voice humbly implore his gracious and free pardon through Jesus Christ, supplicating his divine aid, and above all to cause the religion of Jesus Christ in its true spirit to spread far and wide till the whole earth shall be filled with his glory. That was Sam Adams. He didn't just brew beer. Okay? A lot of people don't know that nowadays. They go, Samuel Adams, man, that's a great bottle of beer. And you know what it is. But that's not the point. Samuel Adams was a very, very, very devout Christian. I'll drink to that. Even those who were cautious about the public expressions of religion left evidence of their views on Christianity. Jefferson wrote, I am a Christian in the only sense in which he wished anyone to be, sincerely attached to his doctrines in preference to all others, I am a real Christian, that is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus Christ. Thomas Jefferson, though a deist, believed that Yeshua was the Messiah. Benjamin Franklin wrote, "As to Jesus of Nazareth, I think the system of morals and his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see." Beyond these many writings, as if further proof were needed, our founders unequivocally enumerated the natural rights of all men in our Declaration of Independence. This is a quote from the Declaration. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." The next line says, "And the reason that we create governments is to secure these rights to the people." Government is not there to give us rights, it's there to secure our rights. Okay. "The conviction that our rights are innately bestowed by the laws of nature and of nature's God is enumerated in the Constitution's preamble of every state in our Union. Thomas Jefferson proclaimed, 'The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time.' Can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are the gift of God, that they are not to be violated but with his wrath? Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever. Prayer is Almighty God's prerequisite for true hope and change, and our nation needs an abundance of both right now." That's the end of the article. It's at thepatriotpost.us. Folks, that is a great article. Although it used that pagan term, Jesus Christ, it tells the absolute truth. Okay, the only thing that I could have done to make that better is to change it to his real name. This was a great article. Folks, I hope that these two articles that I added to Eddie's 5-minute update were a blessing to you. And we'll be back to you in about, we'll play one song, and I'll be back to have a Sabbath service, which is getting started early enough that we can actually get it done by 1 o'clock. This is good.